What's going on, everybody? And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And sitting across from me today is the Momo himself, Mr. Kyle Filio-Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm here in studio. Yes, I'm feeling much, much better. The people in my family, they have not gotten over the illness. Luke is now sick again.
With the flu.
He was patient zero. He came home just the other day, and the doctors tested him, and he has the flu and strep throat. So
we talked about it on OTC. He's still not better. Well, I guess he's a little bit better, isn't he?
Well, as we're recording this, yes, he's better.
He's a little bit better.
But he's been out of school the last 2 days.
So luckily, I've not been sick. I just finished drinking my one of my Moscow Mules when I set this thing down here. I'm having a little mixed drink. Oh, here we go.
All right, see, now we got these. We're trying out the new equipment. We mentioned it on the OTC episode. And also, if you follow the show on Instagram or me personally, you've seen the photographs of this new device. We got two of them, these Rodecaster Pros. And we've been jacking around with it for the last couple hours. And man,
I like it.
I think it really works pretty good. Yeah, there might be a little bit difference in audio. It may not sound as exactly like our last setup. But I will tell you, if you're thinking about starting a podcast, there's no better piece of equipment. I mean, this thing does everything for $600 that everything over here did that was like $5,000.
A whole bunch of money right there, yeah.
It took a long time to piece it together. This is an all-in-one solution.
Yeah.
And these things are brand new. I know Jim Harold uses one. That's how I first tipped off about it.
Yeah.
I think these things were released in December. And there's a lot of people trying to get their hands on them because apparently they've been selling them like crazy. And it's pretty cool. So my vote's not out yet. So far, I like what I see, and so we're going to continue to work with it and see what happens.
And what I was so excited about is they actually have sound effects pads that we can drag and drop and put stuff in, so I'm really looking forward to that. I just got to be careful. It's like putting too much seasoning in a soup. I'll get a little carried away with sound effects. But, folks, I guess we got Lyle on today, my friends. We have Mr. Lyle Blackburn. He's going to be talking about his new book coming out, Momo, the Missouri Monster. We get to interview him about it. We get to talk about some other awesome stuff, and then we just have a great time. But Lyle is also sick. Yeah, Lyle is also fighting like bad allergies and all this stuff, but he agreed to come on. He powered through it. It's just one of those things that everybody down here right now, and I'm sure across the nation, are dealing with some sort of cough and hack. Like it's... I saw again the other day on our weather, it's supposed to be like 72 in another day or so. And then the very next day, it's supposed to be like 41 for a high.
So what does it.
Yeah, we have some crazy ups and downs the pollen. But it was nice and sunny today. Everything worked out. So, like I said, it's been a real wild time the last few weeks. Everybody getting sick and shaking it off, but everybody's getting back in their groove. I guess... We let Lyle go for a while. We get to chat with Lyle, and we have a lot of questions for him. And we don't leave Lyle alone. We should have probably left him alone, but we don't. We just keep asking him stuff.
Yeah, if you're not familiar with Lyle Blackburn, he's been on the show numerous times, but he's a cryptozoologist. He's an author, a researcher, musician, and he's from Texas. And he's written many books, like the Beast of Boggy Creek, The Lizard Man, which is the lizard of Scrapewar Swamp there in Bishopville, South Carolina, as well as what's the other one? The other Boggy Creek,
Beyond Boggy Creek.
That's right. And so now he's writing this new book, Momo, the Monster of Missouri. So it's a pretty cool interview. Lyle's a good guy.
Yeah, it's good. I enjoyed it. I'm really, like I tell him in the interview, I'm really glad that he's the guy that wrote this book, because he did a great job on Boggy Creek. We've had him on, you know, and all that stuff, and he's been in studio and all this. So, yeah, I mean, I'm really glad that Lyle's the guy that wrote this story.
Because about it in the interview, that there's so many researchers and authors out there that they don't really do the groundwork, right? They don't do the boots on the ground. Lyle goes to these places. He finds the actual witnesses, or at least people that are kin to those witnesses, the actual people that were sheriffs and things like that. I mean, he talks to people there that tell their story. Not just searching internet websites for, you know, a copied story.
Exactly.
He meets the real people. And I think that when you're doing this kind of investigative journalism, I mean, that's what it takes. You want to write a story about what the war's like in Iraq. You have to go there.
Yep.
See the people. See the way that's affecting them. And that's what I like about it. In his books, he's a great author. But you can really feel that is when he's talking to the people, even though most of these cases happened a long time ago, they're affected.
Yes.
And so to me, that's my favorite part, and of course, who doesn't like a good monster story?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so let's take a break and let's get into the interview.
Hey,
got, y'all, here we go. The man, the myth, the legend, the fella behind the new book, Momo, The Strange Case of the Missouri Monster, is joining us today, and he's going to open our minds, our hearts, and our ears to all this crazy crypto fun. Mr. Lyle Blackburn, how you doing, amigo?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, guys.
Dude, we haven't. Well, yeah, it's one of those things, you come out with it, we're like, we got to get him on to talk about it. We couldn't have you come over. We're going to have to do them more during like daylight hours so we can all get together and go eat and have a few drinks like last time.
Absolutely.
To go mess around with all that. First of all, like we were talking off air, I can't comment enough on the cover of this book. I love it. Like we were laughing about the font and the way you've got it colored and the way he drew it all up for you. I mean, I really like it, but that's the kind of silliness that I enjoy too. It's one of those things that I like the same horror movies and the old school stuff like we've all laughed about. And I think y'all have knocked it out of the park with this one so far, just on the cover, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. That's always the reward when you put together a book and then, you know, obviously I try to get the best kind of artists, and when they reveal the cover and I'm just like, whoa, my mind is blown, just, you know, and then the book kind of becomes, you know, real at that point. You can see that. And, you know, we tried to kind of have a 70s kind of vibe to it because the story is a lot of it based in the 70s, and, you know, just with the design of the font and everything, just kind of have that really cool retro vibe.
You nailed it. And I guess, okay, this is to get everybody going. Of the Boggy Creek books that you've written and the Lizard Man books that you've written, when you wrote the one Beyond Boggy Creek, you didn't include this in Beyond Boggy Creek, did you?
No. And, you know, at the outset, I had intended to do that. You know, and I was looking at specifically at Southern Sasquatch. So originally my scope was a little more broad, and while Missouri kind of can go either way, get lumped into the north or the south, in the end there was just so much stuff and so many cool stories that I had to limit Beyond Boggy Creek to the deep south, which was more or less 10 states. And I thought also on top of that, Momo, there was just way more to the story, especially with you tie in the periphery of mystery that goes with it and the other stuff.
Yeah. The phenomenon. I can't wait.
I thought, you know, it needs its own book, and, you know, I just, and the way the thing looked, it needed a cover. So I thought, let's just hold that and do a standalone book, which would follow Beyond Boggy Creek. So that's how it worked.
Well, I'm glad you did it. I'm glad you, because for those that, I guess, the uninitiated, those that don't know, the one thing that I really do know about this case is it seems to be, before we get into what the kids saw and how this thing plays out and any of this stuff, you know, it seems to be one of the first cases that I can really clearly remember to where ufologists descended upon this crypto sighting as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of a unique thing about this case is the researchers that were on the ground and interviewing people were actually all of the, you know, UFO background from the MUFON, which was then called the Midwest instead of Mutual UFO Organization. It was, and luckily they were on hand to document some of this because they kind of came across some of the creature sightings that wouldn't have been tied into the story had they not been sort of interviewing for the kind of under the assumption that the creature was possibly an extraterrestrial. So that's why it had all the tie in with the UFOs.
Well, and I know that Nick, we've had him on talking about it, you know, and all that stuff. And you can garner some hate from people when you start mixing the two. It's like people like the UFOs to be in the sky, their Bigfoot on the ground, and that's it. We don't want these to mix. They're not allowed to hang out together. This is an exclusive group, and they're not allowed to cross. And it's funny that people are so a lot of the researchers were that way, and some are still that way.
Yeah. I mean, it is a funny thing, and you know, you don't want to mix the phenomenon. And, you know, for me, I'm not too worried simply because I tell the facts. I mean, it is what it is. I'm not trying to prove one case or the other. You know, I examine the possibilities, and mostly based on what people have proposed and maybe what I see within that. But yeah, this was one that had just a mix of things. And one reason, though, that this it gets mixed is because of the time period. Back in the late 60s and through the 70s, as the paranormal, I guess, became more popular, there was a very much an intermingling of all these phenomenons in one thing. It was just a hodgepodge of a mix. So you would often have ufologists taking reports of Bigfoots and vice versa. And the discipline sort of branched out and became specialized later. But at the time, it was just all considered weird stuff. I mean, you know, the weird 1970s, and it was, you know, Chariots of the Gods, and it was, you know, Bigfoot and Bigfoot on TV, and, you know, Loch Ness and everything all at once. So part of it is the perception of, you know, the time period. And part of it is just because you had a lot of weird phenomenon going on all at one time, and people were trying to make sense of it.
And it's, I'm torn. I kind of like it better. I mean, I understand the specializations,
yeah,
but I still kind of liked it better when everybody was just investigating, you know, had skin in the game all the way around, you know, instead of just going, this is all I'm looking into and I don't care about the other. It's fun because it seems like if you were after everything, you can see these connections sometimes a little more clear than you do if you're just specialized in one thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you need to, you know, and I've occasionally got UFO reports, and I don't, you know, and, you know, if I look at this stuff kind of like, you know, I'm still the kid in the candy store with this stuff. I'm still just, wow, I just think they're so cool, these stories. And when I was a kid, I just thought it was all cool and spooky. And so it was kind of fun in this book to where I could actually write about some other phenomenon that, you know, I haven't normally been able to cover, you know, while I don't, you know, I'm specialized more in the cryptozoology side. I still enjoy ghosts and UFO reports. And, you know, I watched every episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and I love all the weird stuff. So it was fun to actually write something that had just some more flavor to it, I guess, if you will.
This coming from a guy that's written multiple books on crypto animals wants more flavor.
you know, yeah, it's got to reach for a new bang, I guess.
That's right. Well, to get to it, folks, this takes place, the story takes place in, you ready for this? Louisiana, Missouri is where this takes place at. Now, if I'm not mistaken, it's along the Mississippi River, correct?
Correct.
So, yeah, and that's known for some wild stuff all up and down. Of course, any river is kind of always seems to be like a freeway for high strangeness, but it seems like the Mississippi's always got something. There's a lot of history up and down that river. So like you alluded to, this took place in the summer of 72, correct?
That's when it kind of came to light and the public, you know, the public became aware of it.
All right. Well, take it from there and kind of at least give us an outline of what we're looking at.
Well, basically, this all kind of came to the attention of the public when some kids had a sighting, and that was July 11th, 1972. And as you said, they lived in Louisiana, Missouri, which is, try to write a book with that town name in it. It's tricky to say the least, but you know, not to be confused with the state, but it is right there on the eastern border of Missouri along the Mississippi River, which separates it from Illinois. And it's the landscape there is kind of a riverside town. There's rolling hills with farms and rural aspects to it, as well as some forestry. And there's a lot of cave networks up in there. And in this particular town, there is a hill that kind of overlooks the residence there. It's called Marzoff Hill, and it's a wooded, wild place, and it looms above this street where these kids were playing in their backyard, which backs up to Marzoff Hill, and they're out there in the afternoon. And the kids were about eight years old, 5 years old, the young one, but the 8 year old looks up and sees something standing there, and it was standing upright. It was covered in hair, dark hair. It was mangy looking. He said the hair was long on the head and it covered its eyes. It sort of looked ape-like, yet, you know, again, it was standing upright like a human. And he said it was holding what he thought was a dead dog, and he could see blood spattered on this thing's fur. And of course, you know, the two boys just freaked out and started screaming and running towards the house. And their sister was taking care of them at the time, Doris Harrison. And she was about 15 at the time, and she looked out the window, and she also saw this thing standing there in the backyard and got a, you know, it was daylight. She got a great look at it. Well, the kids ran in the house, and, you know, she was just as frightened as they were. And they crowded in there, and they saw this thing walk back off up to Marzoff Hill. And at which time Doris called their mother, who worked at a local restaurant, and said, you know, there's some kind of big hairy monster in the backyard. And the mother subsequently called the dad, Edgar, and had him, you know, come home to check on the kids. And he got there, and, you know, he absolutely believed what they said. There was no doubt that they saw something. You know, there's no doubt about that. And, you know, he kind of looked around the area, found some vague footprints and, you know, evidence that the thing had been there. And that really became the, you know, the substance of the most famous sighting. And it wasn't long before, you know, he called the police, and that ended up in the news, and there was news coverage in local newspapers. And that kind of brought in some residual stuff where other people said, yeah, on that same day or that same evening, we heard a terrible growling sound coming in the vicinity of Marzoff Hill and Harrison home. And, you know, another woman said she saw something, you know, of some kind of big figure run across the road near her home. So you kind of had a compounding effect there of sightings. And then about 3 days later, at the Harrison home, they were having a gathering of a church group that they had at their home each Wednesday or whatever it was. And as the group was done and they were mingling around outside, there was about a dozen of them left. They were standing there talking, and all of a sudden they look up, and in the sky, they see what they described as balls of light coming from east to west. And they flew over the trees and went down in the vicinity of an old school somewhere back over there. Now, of course, these, you know, they didn't look like UFOs or anything, just weird balls of light. And multiple people saw it. And all of a sudden, they also heard this ringing noise, a real strange noise that kind of culminated in a growling sound or something. And everybody's freaking out. And anyway, eventually the Harrison family, Miss Harrison and the kids, they could hear all this stuff, and they came running out of the house, and they said, "Get us out of here. I don't know what's going on." And they all jump in the car. They start driving down the street when they encounter about 40 residents who are sort of armed with, I don't know, clubs and pitchforks. I don't know, but they were coming up the street, and they had also seen the lights, and they could also hear this noise, and everybody was freaked out, and they were headed towards Marzoff Hill. And, you know, Miss Harrison just leaned out the window and said, "It's coming." And they all just took off running. You can't make this stuff up. So in the days to come, there was a lot of news articles, researchers, you know, this, you know, the balls of light in the sky drew in the UFO guys. I mean, within a very quick period, you had, you know, all these people descend on it. The police were involved. They mounted a posse of 20 guys that went up on Marzoff Hill looking for evidence of some sort of a creature. And this just, you know, kind of went on for a period of a couple of months, in which people had strange sightings and all that sort of stuff. And as it went on and sort of slowed up, there became other sightings that became evident that were not necessarily right there in Louisiana, Missouri, and they were kind of tied in on these other rivers and things, and it kind of built a bigger story that seemed to support that perhaps there was some sort of a Bigfoot-like creature on the loose there in this little town. So that's kind of the
long and the short.
Yeah.
Now there's I know there was some other wild stuff that went on at this place, but there was one part that I'd read somewhere, or I can't remember where, that said, now didn't they, somebody see one crawl up out of the water and they thought it was a dirty hippie?
Yes. Yeah. That, yeah. I mean,
that's one of my favorite. When I saw Bigfoot, I swear I thought it was a dirty hippie. And that's just indicative of the time.
Absolutely, man. If you saw a big old hairy thing with long hair on its head crawl up out of the water in 1972, I mean, come on, this was the era of flower power and hippies, and that's your first thought wouldn't be Bigfoot. It would be hippie, dirty hippie.
A dirty hippie crawled out of the river.
You would immediately look to see if there was a VW van or a Good Times van nearby, which could corroborate the hippie sighting.
Looking for weed smoke boiling up off the riverbank.
Yeah. However, in this case, the guys, and this was about, this was at the Couvrain River, which is about, I want to say 20 or so miles south of, you know, the small town. It's right, it's pretty close to the Mississippi River, but it's close to the town. And this was one that was uncovered by some of the UFO researchers. And these guys had said they were out there fishing on the Couvrain River, and they looked up and saw something wading through the water, and they could only see its head, and it had longish hair, and it, you know, hence the hippie thing. But mm-hmm. as it got up out of the water and walked up on the bank, they realized this is some kind of an ape or something. It's covered in hair. It's not a person. And of course they freaked out and eventually, you know, ran and just dropped their fishing gear and ran off and found a park ranger. And they weren't the only ones to report something weird that night. And, you know, while they never could, you know, nobody could ever find the alleged creature, these kind of played into the story because this was happening literally around the same time period. And it was in a place that was, you know, 20 or 30 miles away. So those were some cool sightings and some of the things that play into the story.
Well, and that's what I was wanting to touch on, was this wasn't like a one-time thing that happened there in Louisiana, Missouri. Is that there was, for what most people call it, like when there's a flap, there was a section of time in a little area there that they were a lot of these creatures spotted, like kind of like it was in Boggy Creek, correct?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. There was, you know, a number of solid sightings and a number of sort of this outlying stories that play into it that continued on for a couple of years. And of course, in all these cases, you can find evidence that they had preceded what had become, you know, the first public news worthy sightings. You know, when the Harrisons are often thought of as the first sighting, but it's actually not. A year before that, some women were driving south on Highway 79 that cuts down through Louisiana and heads towards St. Louis, and they were en route to St. Louis, and they were a little bit north of Louisiana, Missouri, and they wanted to stop for lunch, and they found like a scenic turnout there that's pretty close to the river. And they were having lunch, have spread out a picnic, and there was some picnic tables there and stuff at the time. And they started to smell this overwhelming stench. You know, first, you know, they're like, is that skunks? And they're like, nah, I don't think so. And then they looked at the edge of the trees over there, and they could see this ape-like creature staring at them from the, you know, the shadows. And of course they were frightened, and this thing started advancing, coming out of the trees, and they ran and jumped in there. I want to say it was a VW bug. So there is a Volkswagen in the story. And they jumped in that and shut the door and locked it. And this thing just literally walked up right to him and looked right in the window. And this is daylight. I mean, you know, no doubt about it. And they described it as some kind of an ape looking thing. Again, it was described as having long hair in the face. You know, definitely kind of jibed with what people later reported. And they, you know, they didn't have the keys because they left them sitting over there on the picnic table or whatever. And they basically waited till this thing meandered off. It eventually grabbed one of their sandwiches and stuffed it in its mouth and ran back in the woods. And, you know, just freaky stuff. And then they went and reported this to the Missouri Highway Patrol or something once they got back to St. Louis. But this wasn't on the record. See, this wasn't known at all. And then, you know, perhaps not coincidentally, 1 year later, all of a sudden these kids have the sighting, which did make it in the papers. And that's, you know, later on, Lauren Coleman was the one that fielded that report from those women and kind of then said, hey, you know, this was part of the story that, you know, wasn't covered, but these women had seen this thing a year before, and it absolutely, to me, was the same creature. You know, the description and the location, everything jived. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that was one, and a sighting where people go, well, it's just kids in a suit. It's like, dude, these ladies were sitting in a car and it looked in the window.
Now, I think
if it was a crummy suit and any suit by pranksters would have been crummy, how in the world, you know, would they not know it's a costume? I mean, they were adamant that this was some kind of an animal. And their quote was that there could be, in those hills up there, there could be any number of them living out there.
Well, and also that you bring that up, I remember also reading somewhere that I want to say, I can't remember if it was the sighting or if it was the smell or what it was, that they actually called out a rather large search party after the Harrison's sighting in that, like, a few days afterwards, like, where they combed a lot of land, spent a lot of time pushing through the woods to try to find something. And like, you wouldn't just, the police and people around wouldn't just do that if they were thinking it was hoaxers,
kids
playing. Like, they're not going to just go out and put that much manpower and that much effort into it. But I wanted to ask you if that's what I remember was correct. When was it that they found, because this is another thing I want to lead into, the three finger or three toed tracks?
Okay. Yeah. The search party. Yeah, that's absolutely what happened. And the Harrison sighting was on July the 11th and the search party was on July 19th. Sorry for this voice. Yeah, that was like 20 men organized by the chief of police, and the chief of police had seen validity in it. You know, at first he thought it was a hoax, but the more he began to take reports, the more that on, you know, there's news articles that literally say he felt that there was something to it. You know, he was kind of going between, is it a bear, a rogue bear, or is it something else that we can't explain? And he felt the need to, you know, obviously get up there on Marzoff Hill and take a look around, because, you know, it could have been a danger to the residents. So they really did organize this search party. In fact, in my book, there's a picture of some of the guys in the search party literally on Marzoff Hill. So, you know, just think about that for a minute, just like nowadays, like if it was the police were plunging into the woods looking for a monster, it'd just be crazy. But it was the times, that's what was going on. And let's see, what was the
They found the three-toed tracks? Was it during that? Because I guess what I was wanting to know too is, I'm assuming you've been there.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So, and I know, given the time and the age of a lot of the people involved, a lot of the people that were involved that were of older are probably no longer with us. So I'm sure there was a few, but that's like, did you get to talk to any of the guys that were in the search party?
I didn't talk to any of the guys that were in the search party. you know, I talked to Doris Harrison, the girl
that was the sister
sighting. But yeah, a lot of people have passed on. And luckily in these cases, especially in this case, there's a ton of newspaper coverage, especially on that posse. So luckily there was, you know, records of it and had been well covered, because that was big news, I'm sure.
It's just wild to me that the sheriff's department would turn out for something like that. Like you just said, there had to be validity to it, so the sheriff didn't look like a jackass going out there running around in the wood looking for a kid in a Halloween costume.
Yeah. I think you know, like any of the half the town probably thought it was silly, but you had a good portion of people that said, "Hey, you better do something about this. I don't know what it is, but it's scaring us." And I mean, you know, not just, you know, the balls of light in the sky. It wasn't just one person that saw it. It was, you know, dozens or 40 people heard that noise on Marzoff Hill. And the footprints were being found at different times. You had various people reported finding these footprints, and many of them were described as three-toed prints. And when they did the search party, they didn't find anything in particular at that point, but tracks had been found, in that time period. And you had, other sightings, other farmers saw things running across their field. And, you know, there was definitely, evidence that something was going on.
And the tracks, they were found on a couple of different people's places, like the Robbins farm or the Sudarth's farm, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I did meet with Gail Sudarth, who was a young girl at the time, where one of the alleged tracks was found. I don't want to give any spoilers because there's a few, twists and turns in the story and so forth, but yeah
don't let that out. Don't let that out.
But I was able to talk to Gail, and you know, she was, you know, could provide the story on at least one of the tracks. And then some of the others were discussed, you know, in some of the newspaper articles, and in some pictures have been drawn. So yeah, there's some cool stuff regarding that.
Well, you said you spoke to Doris herself, and at the time of the sighting, she was 14 years old. And so you usually have a pretty darn good memory at the age of 14. Now, granted, 14 in 1972 is probably not 14 in 2019, but even then, I mean, yeah, you're going to make some crazy rash decisions, and you know, you may think or see more into it. What I'm going with this is, when you talk to her, out of the people you've interviewed, hundreds of people that have had these sightings and these encounters, you can usually tell if there's a little, you know, smoke to the whole story or whatnot. I want to know, this is like, you could tell how affected was she from this, even to this day?
Well, I think at this point she's somewhat annoyed by it, because I mean, just for the fact that you could tell she was frustrated that a lot of people still don't believe her. And she, you know, in talking to her, and of course, you know, studied the whole story, I can tell you 100%, her and her brothers saw that thing standing there. There's no question about it. There's, you know, and you know, it's affected her whole life ever since, because she can't be separated from it. And she's had questions over and over and over and over. And I was lucky she entertained my, request to be interviewed, because I could tell that she felt like she was, you know, having to prove herself. And I said, you know, hey, look, I have no doubt in my mind you saw what you saw. We can't say exactly what it is, but there's no question to me that you saw it. I mean, I can, you know, I've been talked to many, many people, and I can, you know, there's those ones that are describing an event that happened. And so, you know, it was cool to talk to her, and, you know, she still lives in the town of Louisiana, and, you know, still stands behind 100% about what they saw.
That it's just such a great story. Like, I'm really glad you did it. I'm really glad it's you that decided to go out there and do it. And I'm not just saying it because we're friends. I mean, I'm saying it because you're a very good writer. And what I mean by that is you go and get the stories. Like, you don't, your books doesn't seem like you try, you don't try to interject your opinions or your assumptions. It's like you go and document the people and let them tell their stories and let the story tell itself. And that's all anybody can really ask for. You know, we're not asking you to go out and prove that you're some type of specialist. We just need like a documentarian. And so you doing that, and then that's when Kyle and I got all excited whenever you and Seth and all the small town monster guys started working together, because we're like, now this is perfect. Now we're going to have it in book form and then in video form, which is going to be great.
Yeah, yeah. Seth and I, you know, click on the approach we take to these and how we, you know, research and tell the story. So it's always worked well for us, and you know, with the Momo story, I mean, I feel like it's my best written book to date. And I mean, you know, the feedback from my editor, who is one of the only ones that's read it, was very, very, very positive. And, you know, I went there and went to the town, and it's a little bit about, you know, the narrative is me, you know, hey, I know this story. I loved it since I was a kid, and let's go, let's take this trip up to Marzoff Hill and let's just check it out ourselves. So it's, you know, kind of follows me somewhat in going there, and then the story unfolds, and then my reflections at the end when I'm literally standing right there on what is the remains of that old scenic turnout where those women had that sighting in 1971. And I mean, I was standing right on it, and just kind of thinking about this whole thing against the scenic background of, you know, I could throw a rock and hit the Mississippi River and the railroad tracks that run along there, right along the riverbank, and the hill behind me. And it was just a real cool place and a great vibe. I kind of felt like I could feel the spirits of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn channeling. Like if they were cryptid researchers, this is what they would have investigated.
Well, I can relate to that, because what I always liked the Lake Worth Monster, and the very first time I ever got to visit where that went down was standing beside you, and then you telling me to go up on this hill, and I went and stood on this big cliche hill, and you're like, if you could throw a tire from there to there, then you would know what the monster did. I mean, because that you walked us through exactly what you walked through. You walked Kyle and I through it here in Lake Worth. So I can kind of relate to what you went through up there in Missouri, is because for us, it was a dream come true because we got to see all this. Yeah, we're like, Dude, Lyle's walking us through it. He's showing us where it all took place, how it all went down. I can only imagine your excitement up there for you, because this was your, one of your childhood funds to go and do this up there.
Yeah. Yeah. It is cool. And it's, you know, it's great that we have Lake Worth in our backyard, and then as you expand out with these stories, to be able to go, you know, as far away as Missouri, and to be able to go to the places. And, you know, I was standing, I mean, I literally stood there where Doris Harrison and the kids saw it. I mean, I you know, their home is no longer there, but the property, she told me right where it was. And so I was able to go there, and I, you know, I was literally standing right where the creature stood, just like, you know, we did at Lake Worth, and that really puts the perspective on it. As I'm standing there and, you know, reflect back, and they're just on all the craziness that went on. So it makes a great entry to the story when I can say, you know, the journey started with me going there.
Well, it's going to be, I can't wait. Like, I'm really, really super excited to get to read it, get to do the whole thing. But I know there's something else I want to talk to you about too. Now that we got that, we can't put it all like the cat out of the bag. So we want to talk to you about this. I know you're doing the narration, the voiceover work for The Terror in the Skies for Seth and all that. So I have to ask you now about your ideas on these giant birds. Now, I know our buddy Ken Gerhard, he's written books on it. He's been involved in this stuff too, but I want to pick your brain about it and the places that you've been. What are some of your takes on that?
Well, you know, to me, it gets a little harder to explain. And of course, when you talk about the giant bird phenomenon, you've got two aspects. You've got the feathered kind, the kind of the thunderbird, enormous, you know, wingspans and huge, you know, birds that can't be explained. And then you've got the pterosaur type, the leathery skin pterodactyl, if you will, dinosaur, relic dinosaur types. And I've had, you know, reports come to me of both kinds, and they've been in places that I don't know, that you may not expect them to be, like, we, you know, Oklahoma or near a park in New Jersey, or just random places. Like, you're trying to get your mind around this. And for me, again, the witnesses, a certain amount of them, you know, describe in very vivid detail, and they had a clear sighting. A lot of these sightings are in the day, because, you know, whereas Bigfoot, a lot of it, you know, maybe night or whatever, you know, these birds, you know, fly in the day, and the people see them in clear daylight. I don't know exactly how to explain it. I can say that some of the Thunderbird sightings, or the pterosaur type sightings on in the Southwest Texas, the Rio Grande area and things, mm-hmm. those seems more plausible, because there's a lot of space out there. A bird could roost up in there, and it would be kind of hard to find. You know, you may see it flying, but you're not, there's not a lot of foot traffic that's going to run across their nests or anything. It seems plausible. When you start getting up in Oklahoma, I have a hard time explaining how the birds aren't being seen more. You know, they're bird watchers and other things, but that doesn't mean that it's impossible. It's just that it's an enigma that we can't explain. I've done a lot of study on swampy places, and I've also found there's a number of sightings of pterosaurs in swamp areas, which, you know, swamps can be remote and would provide, you know, a place for them to nest. And so that, you know, may be a place that could harbor these type things. But it's hard to imagine that something that is known from the fossil record, and something that has, you know, fairly definitively been said to have gone extinct, that there are some survivors, especially survivors that could fly across metropolitan areas of, you know, of the U.S. So I don't know how to explain that, but you've got cases like, and I know Seth's going to cover this in the movie, the famous case of Marlon Lowe in Illinois, the kid that was in his yard, and this huge feathered bird literally tried to pick him up, mm-hmm. and carry him off. And that was seen by multiple witnesses. So he, you know, you cannot argue that that was an incredibly large bird. It's just a matter of what the hell was it, you know?
Yeah.
Big enough to almost lift him up off the ground. So, you know, again, there's a good case for anomalous birds being out there. It's just been hard to prove what they are.
It's funny that you bring up, like, it, you see them here that you could expect them in South Texas, but here's different, because Kyle and I talk about it all the time. It's like, why do I believe that in the Pacific Northwest I could think about there being a giant ape, or in East Texas, or what, I could picture that, but like, if somebody claimed they had some sightings of something, some hairy hominid, like in on the island of New York, you know, in an outlet, you'd be like, there's no way, somebody messing with you. Like, there's no way, you know, or just anything like that, you know, on the outskirts of Dallas, if they claim they saw, you'd be like, there's no way. I'm like, I don't know why I'm that way, but I'm bad about going, well, it just doesn't fit. So it's not, like even the Lake Worth Monster, knowing where it's at now, I'd be like, no, come on, it's not there. But then I got to remind myself that back then it was different than it is now.
Yeah, you know, you got a good BS meter. I mean, there's certain stuff, and I've noticed there's a pattern between people who report these things in what I or you guys would probably consider unlikely environments. I tend to find those witnesses to be the least credible. The ones that live out in the country, you know, people would call them hicks or whatever. But I'm sorry, these people have, in my mind, some of the most credible stories, and they're seeing that these creatures in places that it seems much more probable. So, you know, the the people who tell me they see, they just had a sighting in Rockwall, Texas, which is barely outside of the urban zone of Dallas. You know, I called this dude on the phone. I'm like, I, you know, in 10 minutes, I was like, okay, yeah, this guy's full of crap, you know? And that kind of backed up my first reaction, was that there is no Bigfoots roaming around in that area. They may have once been there, and there are some sightings on record, but at this point, they would have had to retreat to more remote areas. Simple as that. And sure enough, you know, you talk to a witness, and you're kind of like, yeah, there, this is not a good sighting, and it doesn't make me think that there's Bigfoots in Rockwall.
Mm-hmm. Well, what else have you been working on? This has been keeping you busy and all that, but I know that you've always got other stuff going on. What other stuff have you been working on?
Oh, man. Yeah, a lot of stuff. The Momo book and, you know, I've done narration for some of Seth's other movies. The Bray Road Beast was the last one. You know, and we've been talking, obviously, about the upcoming Momo movie we're going to film. We start filming in May, so, you know, we always start talking about that. You know, band stuff with Ghoultown, mm-hmm. my band. I've been working on new songs with them, and, you know, kind of, I got to juggle all this sort of because of, that's how I make my income, is music and the book. So, and I've done just a ton of events, and I've got a ton of events coming up all over the country. I'll be speaking and doing book signings and stuff. And so, you know, I've been scheduling those and working out the logistics, and I've written about half of another book already. So, see what else. Writing for Rue Morgue magazine. I wrote some articles for Fate magazine that are going to come out soon. So much
grinding. So, okay. You've got to have some that you can share. Have you gotten any more really wild besides the guy in Rockwall, or the human in Rockwall that gave us the BS thing? Have you got any good ones that you can talk about that you may have got in the last month or so?
As far as good ones, there has been some good, credible ones. You know, people always want to know if there's been any sightings around Boggy Creek or Falk, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did have one from October in which a couple of residents were driving north on Highway 71, the little highway that runs up through Falk, and they weren't that far from Boggy Creek, and they saw this bipedal, upright, big figure come up out of the woods and run across that highway in very few strides and head down this side road. And they turned around to try to catch another glimpse, and it was so fast, it just trucked off in the woods. And these were individuals that they, you know, knew the legend and the stuff, and they, you know, were kind of neither here nor there with it, whether they believed, but after seeing this, they were quite certain in their mind that this wasn't a person. It wasn't a person in a costume. It wasn't a hoax. And, you know, of course their mind was kind of changed and was seeing something like that. So that's been the latest Boggy sighting. There's been quite a few over the last few years that I thought were great. In doing some other research, I've turned up some really good witnesses in the Honey Island Swamp Monster case. And these were ones that date back to the 1960s.
Really?
Which are hard to find because, you know, mostly it's thought that Harlan Ford and those guys, Billy Mills, were the ones that saw it in the 60s. But I found two other witnesses that had sightings, and that one of them predating that. And I was able to talk at length with one of these witnesses who was a girl at the time, but she was quite certain that what she saw was not a bear. She saw it in daylight. It looked like a gorilla. She even drew this color, like a matte penciled colored drawing of what she saw. And it's clearly a female, kind of an ape looking thing. It's really freaky. And so it was cool because those are the cases, those vintage cases that I really like. And it's often very hard to find a good solid witness that had a sighting, you know, that goes back that far. So that was some cool stuff.
Hey, Lyle, when you decide you're going to write a research on a particular subject and you go to these towns, how do you go about finding the people, like the people that are behind, like some of the famous cases, like the Momo Monster and things like that? How do you find the actual people? Like, what is your, I mean, you don't have to give away any secrets, but like, I'm always curious, is like, every time Lyle writes one of these books, he meets the actual people, or he talks to previous sheriffs and things like that. Like, how do you go about doing something like
that? Have you seen him? He's a cool looking dude. They're not going to talk to you, Kyle.
That's true.
I don't know, man. I march in there like, what is this guy? He can't write a book. He don't look like a writer. You know.
But I'm always shocked because there's a lot of people that write on these things, but lots of times you can tell they're just doing their research off the internet. But you're actually going, every book you've written, you've actually gone to the location, you've actually met eyewitnesses. How do you go about collecting that kind of information?
Usually, you know, in two ways. I can start with, looking up Doris Harrison in the phone book and you know, trying to call her that way and see if she's open to an interview and, you know, preface that with, hey, I'm going to come to town and things like that. And then, you know, there's obviously people that can't be found. So just going to the location usually yields good stuff. And, you know, unfortunately, Missouri's a far, far away, so I can't, you know, keep going back and forth. But by going there, you know, I usually show up at the library in places where there's people who will at least appreciate the history. So, you know, I march in the library and announce who I am and what I plan to do. And usually, you know, hopefully they don't look at me like I'm nuts or whatever. And, you know, a lot of that will yield, you know, well, hey, you know, we know so-and-so and, you know, their grandmother was the one who had a sighting, and that, you know, that kind of will one thing, and I'll get a number. And a lot of it is also from doing the conferences and book signings. I was up in Missouri, back in September, October, it's various locations, and sure, you know, people who come to see me at the libraries and things where I'm doing a presentation are all interested in the subject. And sure enough, you know, you'll meet somebody who'll say, hey, you know, by the way, I know this person, or, hey, I had a sighting. And that has always been a way for me to get some good information. And in fact, in Momo, there's a really great sighting in Missouri that I got because I went there and spoke, and the guy showed up and he was super cool. And in fact, went out and got me pictures of the location and sent them to me. And, you know, so usually boots on the ground, it yields things that you wouldn't get if you're just sitting here trying to write a book by Googling it. If
right.
You do that. And, you know, I mean, if you look at the stories on Momo, they're fairly accurate, but they're leaving out a ton of it. And it's all these blogs, if you search it, 90% of it, you can always trace back to Lauren Coleman. They've stolen it from one of his books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's nothing new. There's nothing they did that adds to it. They're just regurgitating stuff with no credit to Lauren whatsoever. And of course, I know that if I need to find out something about the original stuff, I just call up Lauren and go to the source, you know. So having achieved a level of respect and friendship and being a colleague, that I can also call on these other folks who may have done previous search and say, hey, you know, can you help me find this person? Or, hey, tell me some more about this. So I like to have that network of people that I work with, and that's very beneficial.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad there's people like you out there doing all the grunt work. Tell people how they can get a hold of this book.
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked me that. I sound terrible.
He just turned 14, folks. He's 14.
I did an interview this morning. And then I've been working on Ghoultown songs all day, which I've been singing. And, yeah, my voice is just sounds like the Missouri Monster, but that's a good effect. But anyways, yes, you can find information on me, my books, films, and everything else at LyleBlackburn.com. And that's got links to all the places that you can get it. Of course, my books are on Amazon and barnesandnoble.com, and you can buy autographed copies from me at my online store. So if you just go to lyleblackburn.com, you can find all of that information. Momo, The Strange Case of the Missouri Monster book will come out March 5th. Possibly I can get it up for pre-order, but it's getting pretty close. So that should be out pretty soon.
Well, what about any of your upcoming speaking engagements as well? You said you were booked solid going and doing all this. Lay it on us.
Okay. Let me look. Let me, you know how I know what I'm doing in life? I look at my own website.
Right.
this is actual truth. Somebody called me a
baby.
You
look at your website, or you have to ask your wife, where am I supposed to be this weekend?
well, no, it's actually, she asked me where I'm going to be. So
that's how well she keeps up. Like, aren't you going to be out of town this weekend? We got plans.
Yeah, it's very complicated. We must plan years in advance to have a night. But yes, I've got a lot of stuff. Starting February 24th, I'm going to be up the Arkansas Museum of Natural Resources in Smackover, Arkansas.
And, Kyle used to date an old gal from there.
Oh yeah, we all dated them girls from Smackover. I won't say anything more about that name, but yeah. And then there's an Oklahoma Bigfoot Symposium that happens every year in Stillwell, Oklahoma. That's March 9th and 10th, and I'll be out at the amazing Expedition Bigfoot Museum in Georgia in the middle of March. And if people haven't seen that museum there in Cherry Log, Georgia, it is absolutely amazing, and you should go there. And I'll be doing a speaking presentation there on March 16th, and then I'll be at the Dallas Public Library on March 30th, and just goes on and on, actually.
How many miles have you put on those feet around the world and all over the continent? You've put a lot of mileage on those feet, brother.
Yeah, there's a lot, considering I spent, most of my youth and 20 years touring as a musician in strange countries and playing in strange locations in Europe and everywhere else. So, yeah, it's funny because I thought, yeah, I'll write a book. It'll be this laid back career of some sort. Dude, I'm out there. I'm on tour as much or more than I ever was in a band, and doing this, but it's fun, and I don't have to drag around equipment, or, I don't have to play till 2 a.m. I can, it's a lot of fun.
Your voice and your fingers don't hurt as bad after you're done.
Yeah, even though my voice is apparently suffering, but that
it's
was
puberty. Part, everybody goes through it, Lyle. It's okay.
Yeah, I'm getting on up there in age, and it's puberty's hitting me.
So that's right. Rough. We're going to have to get you to come in the studio again when we do one of the off the cuff that we do, where we don't really cover anything in the paranormal realm. It's just us talking. We need to get you to come in and sit down and do, like we talked about, the tales of the tour bus with us, so we can hear some crazy stories about being on the road.
Absolutely. That would be funny, because, yeah, I've got a lot of crazy tales. And that's another book that I just haven't got to yet. There's so many books, a little time, but yeah, I intend at some point to write some kind of a book about my experiences with the music and travel around the world. So that would be pretty good.
Well, we'll get it set. We'll reach out, get back in touch. We'll get it set up so we can get you to come in here whenever you slow down in the next couple of months. We'll catch you one day and stick you in here, and we'll just record it.
Absolutely.
All right, brother. Thank you so much for taking time out, even though you didn't feel great, for coming on the show and chatting it up with us and letting us know. We really appreciate it.
Hey, man. It's always a pleasure, dude.
And if you got anything else, like we said, let us know. We'll take care of it. We'll get it out there. We'll try to get everybody to come hang out. So, again, folks, make sure you go check out the Momo book. And like I said, pre-order it. If you can pre-order it, just go ahead and get it. Let's support Lyle. Let's get him out there working even more so he writes more books, and then we can get him on and let him make fun of his voice. So, all right, brother, we'll let you go. Thanks. And we are back. And again, thanks so much to Mr. Lyle Blackburn for taking time out of his day, yeah, out of his evening to sit down and discuss all the fun stuff with us. But like we said, dude, we can't tell. There's a lot of other stuff that we can't really, I guess we can. Anybody that listens can go and do it for themselves. But we can't let all the fun go away. I mean, that's the reason you want to buy the book. But
oh, yeah, you're talking about releasing or revealing the whole story. Yeah, you can't give
away. The stuff that he's talking about yeah, because I kind of looked in on some of it. And so, yeah, it's one of those deals that, but I don't know all of what he found. He found more. Like what he's talking about, I asked him about off air, and he found more of it. So there's more that goes into the story. And I can't wait for the book to get here.
You got
to
pick up the book.
Literally, I'm fixing to. Yeah,
March 5th. So if you have a person in your life that is big into cryptozoology, is a big fan of Sasquatch or Bigfoot, man, it'd make a perfect gift.
Yeah,
Valentine's Day is coming up.
If you're a fan of Lyle and you like to collect, yeah, collect them because I've got them.
I've got every book he's written in hardcover.
If they made them in hardcover, I got them in hardcover.
Yeah, so pretty cool, man. If you want to, I'll put links to it in the show notes, of course, but you can just go to LyleBlackburn.com and you can buy everything there from posters to t-shirts.
And I will be owning a poster of the book cover of this Momo book. It looks awesome too. That's what we talked about is he's an artist. So he's a great musician, but he appreciates art and he appreciates a certain genre that goes with a certain story. Like he knows how to tell a story.
Yeah, he does.
And so he knows visually, and I mean everything. That's the reason I think he does such a great job when he does all the narration for Seth on Small Town Monsters for those guys. It's a great. I don't know. They just work great together. I even told him in the interview they work great together. And folks, just so you know, next week we're going to have Randall Carlson on.
That's right.
He's going to be on the show.
So I was talking with Randall today, actually.
Yeah, you called me when it was over. It's like, I can't believe I just spent the last 20 minutes talking to Randall.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I'm sitting here working away in at my office, and all of a sudden my phone rings, and I look, and it's Randall Carlson. He's like, hey, Kyle, it's Randall. I'm like, yeah, I'm aware. Your voice is, there's no way I didn't recognize it.
Exactly. You're like, yes, sir.
Yeah, that's the way, right? I'm like, oh, God, he's calling me. Don't mess up. Yeah, right. I don't know why I feel that way.
Because we're an idiot.
Well, he's one of the guys that I've wanted to talk to for a long time. And it's just, we always got busy somehow. Like, yeah. I was even talking to him about, like, how I had spoken to his handler, Cameron, at the time for a while. We just never got around to it. But this will be another one of those things, much like Robert Schock, much like John Anthony West. Randall Carlson's another guy that I think years from now I'll be looking back and saying, man, I'm glad I got to talk to him.
Exactly, yeah.
He's just so interesting. He's such a well of knowledge. He just seems to know so much.
Yeah. He knows. I would like to look inside of his mind.
Man, me too.
Because I'm not smart enough to understand some of the stuff he talks about.
Right.
I'm like, no, Randall, I don't know what you're talking about.
What do you got planned for your week?
Just same old, same old. Doing work and prepping for shows, and that's pretty much it. I think I may build a desk.
I'm just here trying to get everybody not sick in my house.
Good luck with all that.
Yeah.
Good luck with all that stuff. Although I did get a picture of Caleb at the archery range.
Yeah.
And he was up there shooting. And he's holding a Robin Hooded arrow, folks. So that's where the tip of one arrow goes into the back end of the other arrow, just like the old Robin Hood shows. Except the bow he shoots doesn't have enough poundage, so it didn't go into the arrow shaft. It just split the arrow nock, but it's still holding at the back of the other arrow. And to be honest, the kid looks very unhappy in this picture. It looks like somebody just backed over his dog right before they took the photograph.
You're supposed to be excited when you do something like that, especially as a kid. I remember the first time I did it as a kid. I mean, I was ecstatic. Like, can
He's
you believe
not happy.
It? He looks ticked off.
Because it ruined the arrow.
Because I guarantee that's what it is. He probably ruined his favorite arrow or who knows what. Yeah,
he's mad. Yeah. He's mad about it.
That's the way he always is.
This picture, he's got this look of just total, like he's tired of the day. The look on his face is how I look every Monday morning when I get up.
Well, let's get out of here. If you have any stories of your own you'd like to share with me and Cam, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Also, you can follow us on all forms of social media. Don't forget about Expanded Perspectives Elite. There's extra content over there. Just go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Click on the Elite tab and sign up. You get access to our entire back catalog, as well as additional shows every month. Till next time, folks, be careful. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.